So maybe I'm going to, so probably it's not the first time most of you hear me talk about this Gross-Peterjewski equation, also a traveling wave. Actually, that's we started to work on this equation with Jean-Claude Tso already, I think since my last visit to Toronto, that was 6 years ago. So is it working? Yeah, it's okay? Because at the time, we had the first work, and we raised a number of conjectures. Recently, some of them have been solved by Philippe Kravjas, so I will try to report on this first, and then also maybe I will talk about some new work we have with Gian Domenico Orlandi from Verona and Didier, who you heard already. And so this is more in the Ginzburg-Landau framework. Maybe first I will try to avoid to speaking about epsilon. So what is the Gross-Peterjewski equation? So that's you have some stick or something? Okay, over here, I do it with hand. No. Okay, I can do it with the hand. Okay. So that's a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which is very rather simple. So the nonlinearity is here, so the phi squared, and it is called Gross-Peterjewski equation because it appears in various areas of physics, and especially in Bose condensation. I think that comes to terms of this, and it was worked out first by these two people. I guess independently. As a matter of fact, it's a nonlinear Schrödinger equation of defocusing type. So basically, when you do this this transformation, you end up with this equation, which is maybe most commonly used. And as you see here, the sign is plus, which is considered in this equation. So it's not, if you will, for this equation, the energy would be gradient u squared over 2 plus, I guess, u at the power 4 over 4. So the sign plus is, of course, important since this is conservative. And basically, what you expect is not too many troubles for this equation. However, so maybe the first question one might ask is why not looking at this equation and not at the other one, which looks a little bit more complicated. So one way to saying it is, okay, this looks more like Ginzburg-Landau, and so we just can go back to the original subject. But that's not really the main, well, maybe it's a good reason, but not the only one. The main reason is that here we specifically are interested in solution whose modulus goes to 1 at infinity. So here, the domain here is Rn, it's a whole domain. And the modulus is supposed to go, in some sense, let me not be too precise at this stage, to 1 at infinity. Whereas when you write in this way, basically what you expect is the solution to have, say, bounded energy of this form. So they essentially goes to 0 at infinity. And the fact that you have a plus sign, of course, it's important because if it's a minus, you might have, I don't know, explosions and so on. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why this equation has a different name. And consistent with the previous discussion is the fact that now we can write the energy in a little different way, which, of course, looks more like what the usual stuff we had before. And so you have the gradient as before, but here you see you have the power 4 in this term, but it's written in such a way that this term will be, will be supposed to be finite. And our investigation goes only on finite energy solution to this energy. So when you're looking at the previous equations of the ones which go to 0 at infinity, they have no finite Ginzburg-Landau energy. So it's a way to select the value of the modulus at infinity. Okay, that's Okay, that's more or less what I said. So if the energy is finite, it cannot be in L2, and so on. Of course, you have many solutions with finite energy. It suffices to take functions which are in H1 plus, say, some constant of modulus 1, any constant, but 1 is, of course, easiest to think, and then the energy will be bounded. The converse is not true, of course. It's not because you have a bound on this Ginzburg-Landau energy that the modulus has to go, the function has to go to 1. The modulus has to go to 1 in some sense, but not the function itself. It might oscillate at infinity. Okay. So, maybe just a few words about motivations, maybe. As I said, there are numbers of motivation. As I said, also the name, which is actually it's a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, but the name came from this motivation. So the first one was a Bose condensation with an interaction term. Then, of course, maybe I think Amandine or somebody else discussed this before. It has been thought as a model for superfluids, and the discussion of fluid, it's very difficult this term, but maybe it could be a toy model for superfluids. But also there are motivation from nonlinear optics, and most of the references I will take from physicists come from this domain. So in the 70s and 80s, we were interested in some special models in this domain. As I guess also many works in the Schrödinger equation came from motivation from optics at some stage. So, of course, the first question you might raise, and this is not so, so completely clear, what is a good question? You might first think about the Cauchy problem, and as you see, the fact that you're, so for instance, if you take this kind of initial value, then it's pretty easy to prove that the Cauchy problem is well defined in the space H1, say, plus 1. So, of course, when you have an energy bound, it's clear that the gradient has to belong to L2. However, as I mentioned before, the function itself is not necessarily in L2. And it's not completely clear that's the right Cauchy problem for this type of equation. The only thing I can say is that it works without too many work. Basically, you rely on the theory by Cato, standard theory for this existence problem. And then, working in that framework, you also know that everything goes well. So first, you have a solution, and the energy, as expected, is conserved in this space. So the space here, where maybe we would like to work, would be 1 plus, say, H1. So, and H1, as mentioned, means that V belongs to L2. So basically, the and another quantity which is conserved is the momentum, and maybe as I wrote it here, it's not clear that it's well defined, but if you write it that way, I u minus 1 grad u, which is essentially the same, when you see that this belongs to L2, and maybe Cauchy-Schwarz or some Diesen inequality will help you to prove that it's finite. So these quantities are conserved during the flow, and they play, of course, a very important role in the discussion. It's always good to have conserved quantities. However, there are kind of difficulties to define the momentum in the energy space. So basically, the space, well, maybe I should have put another, let's call it W. The space where, which is natural for this energy is a space, which is not a linear space, of course, of maps U with finite energy. However, in this space, the momentum is not extremely well defined, so it's not clear how you can make, you can define this quantity if you just have no assumption on the L2 norm. So a clear counter example is the following one. you take something which is a pure phase, and then you tune everything up in such a way that this quantity, so this quantity basically, if you are a pure phase, it's just a gradient of a phase, and being a finite Ginzburg-Landau energy means that the gradient belongs to L2, and of course it's not too difficult to cook out somebody who is in L2 and not in L1. You just have to tune the exponents correctly. So that I already said, so that on this page also, I finally found the right letter. On this page, everything goes right, and this is not so easy to deal with from the point of calculus of variation. So the first important aspect, so I will first go into some generalities, which are, however, I think quite interesting. The first important aspect of this equation is in the case where you might have, actually basically when a function does not vanish, you might write always the thing in that way, so a modulus times the exponential of a phi, and that's called the Madelung transformation. So of course you very simple. Also, I don't really know what was the contribution of Madelung in this thing to write it that way. So my guess, maybe it was, or maybe it was just there was a conference and somebody made a joke like. So we were asking if maybe next year somebody will come with some ideas. So maybe that was a, so let's see. So, but I think also the square root maybe was of importance. I don't know. Yeah. So anyhow, when you use it that way, then you said looking at say v should be considered as a vector here. If you want, I can also put an arrow on the gradient. And of course, this is a say n equal to 3, which is more relevant. But this is a vector, and of course, rho is a scalar. And then you get these two equations, which are very reminiscent of fluid mechanics. Basically, so this term is usually called the quantum pressure in the literature, but if you think it's small, and in some regimes you might possibly just remove it, then this really looks like a compressible Euler equation with some pressure law, which is given below. And one of the things you might expect is to get acoustic waves, which are exactly the speed of sound in this context, which is square root of 2. So here also that's a big difference between physical papers and mathematical papers. Of course, a reasonable thing would be to have the speed of sound equal to 1, of course. But we didn't realize it at the beginning when we worked on this with Jean-Claude Sour, but then you have to put the 1/2 in front of a Laplace, and that's very, for people like us coming from elliptic background, that was too much. So. But nevertheless, let's think that square root of 2 is 1 and change the... So basically the fact that you might neglect the quantum pressure, that's only possible in the long wavelength regime. So that's the speed of sound. Basically, when you're looking at the dispersion relation, that's what you get. So basically... if you forget about this term, so which is, of course, not relevant for, and this term, you really get some possibility of propagation of waves with constant speeds. The fact that you have things which travel very fast here from the K4, that's of course related to the basic nature of Schrödinger equation. So, the first thing you might get is to look at some special solution. And usually what you do first is to look to standing waves, solution to this equation, to get some, say, some feeling for what it's going up here. And of course, so standing wave solution, you might write it in this form, and then you get an equation for the profile, and so you get the Ginzburg-Landau equation on the space Rn. And of course, if omega is less than one, when that's just the standard stuff, and it's not so. So basically, you don't have finite energy solution to this. And on the other hand, it's maybe not so interesting. So the most interesting object is probably the probing wave, which you look next. And so this are solution, special solution of the form which is written here. So U is the profile again. And it travels with constant speed c. And here I will assume that the speed c is going along the, say, x1 axis, x2 axis. So it's going that way. And it stays constant during time. So, of course, it's not difficult to write from this ansatz the equation for the traveling wave equation, which you just get at one stroke, and it's, of course, completely equivalent. So solving the traveling wave equation, goes back to solve this equation. And as I mentioned before, our emphasis was on the finite energy solution. So I do not pretend that there do not exist other kind of solution, but and presumably even the infinite energy solution of interest, even for physical purposes, but we studied this at least. And so what are the questions? First questions, of course, existence, non-existence, what kind of speeds you're allowed to have, maybe uniqueness, non-uniqueness, and so on. So the standard stuff you might think. Of course, this these solutions, if they exist, and if you're able to prove some stability result, and we'll come back to this later, are of interest if you would like to study the whole dynamics of the system, because somehow they lay into the way to, say, scattering theory or whatever you would like to consider. So you have somehow to get some feeling about these guys, and if they exist, or if they do not, so it's maybe an empty theorem. Okay. So one question is, of course, maybe just for people who are very familiar in this Schrödinger business, is that usually what you say is that from a standing wave solution you get a traveling wave solution by Galilean boost. So the question is, why are these things not related in this setting? And the answer is, like before, it's because of the energy constraint of the value at infinity. So if you're doing this boost, then at infinity you have too much energy. So you're varying here, and this does not work. Of course, maybe I should not mention it. I should mention it. It's that there's a trivial traveling wave, so which is the constant solution, but that maybe are not so interesting. And in case I speak of solution, I always mean non-trivial. So that's the main thing I would like to mention. So before I go to existence results, so there's a before I go to existence result, let me mention some properties of this solution. At the end, actually, it turns out that the study of the properties, qualitative properties of the equations and the solution, are finally as important as existence result. Because once you you know this, and first you know where you have to look for the solutions, and second, you might handle them more properly, in particular, handle issues like stability, for instance. So the first thing, which so it was a long-standing conjecture, actually, this theorem, and I should mention that it was presumably first raised in the 70s by physicists like Robert Drummond, Putterman, and they had some argument on a more say heuristic level that there should not exist traveling waves of cinetic energy to this equation with speed higher than the speed of sound, which is maybe a sort of classical result maybe you can find in other equations. And I must say that you tried very hard with, I should not say with whom, but at least I tried the Jean-Claude also. But, we couldn't solve this question, and it was recently solved by Philippe Gravejar. So it's a few months ago, and it will appear in Communication of Math Physics. And, the way he proves this is very, very, skillful and very, interesting, I think. I will come to his proof later, and it has nothing to do with any proof we might have thought of. So our attempts didn't go in that direction, and it's really surprising that it works, right? I'm not sure I completely understand the deep reason why it works, but so let's first see what is the heuristic reason for this conjecture. It's basically when you look at the linear operator around the Eurinized close to the constant solution models of u equal 1, or say u equal 1. So of course u equal 1 is the solution, and then you have a nonlinear operator, and then you're looking at this nonlinear operator, and basically it has a continuous spectrum, and if the speed c square is larger than 2, then the spectrum is 0 plus infinity, whereas if smaller than 2, and if it's less, it's larger than 2, then basically you have a negative part of the spectrum. I think it's over 2, but maybe it's not completely sure. And so you have lots of, say, pseudo-negative eigenvalues, and basically you don't expect to have such unstable solutions. So there's also maybe some reason with spectrum. But due to the fact that it's a system, you cannot apply proofs coming from, say, linear theory, at least we couldn't do it. And so let me just briefly indicate his proof. So, of course, I'm not used to hide things, but let's just hide. So, of course, if you have a result of non-existent, or say, exist only constant solution, the first trick you will use would be, I guess, everybody who's doing elliptic PDEs using the Porosyev trick. So you first start with Porosyev, and then you get one identity. So that's good, but that basically gives you a relation between the energy and the momentum. So you have two quantities and C. And so one relation is not enough to rule out anything, I guess. So then his trick was to use other identities. And how is he doing this? It's looking the thing in the Fourier mode, and basically he's looking at some linearized operator corresponding to the equation, and then you write it in a sort of a quotient, and what happens is that if c squared is less than 2, then essentially the only zero of h is 0. So it's sort of elliptic operator, whereas when c squared is larger than 2, then you have a zero set in the Fourier mode, which my picture is maybe not, it should be number 8, so it should be some kind of symmetric thing. Topologically, it's convincing, but maybe not geometrically. And so what he was doing is to look at the tangent plane here, and looking the two directions here, he was able to derive two new relations, which are sort of miracle, at least when you see that. And from this new integral relation, he's able to rule out the possibility of having c squared minus 2 larger than 2. So he has to use, of course, the finiteness of the energy. And so it's a sort of new Porosyev type identities, which are relevant, which actually are never relevant, because if c squared is less than 2, then you have no, doesn't give you anything. And when c squared is larger than 2, then you have just a constant solution. So no solution meets them, but however, they're good enough to rule out the existence of any other kind of solutions. Okay, so that's his theorem. Let me mention another theorem of Grave-Jarre, which is also extremely interesting in this context. Of course, just a side remark is that, of course, in view of this spectral problem, you cannot expect to find solution. You will not expect to find solution for, large, if we didn't have this theorem by Grave-Jarre, because, of course, the spectrum is too large. You cannot find it variationally. But this proves that it's not, there are no solution of this type. So, an earlier theorem he proved, but not much earlier, is about, as you see, so when the dimension is larger than 3, but say stick to 3 since it's more physical, then you're looking any finite energy solution to the equation with speed, of course, less than square root of 2, then this solution belongs to the space you expect to have a nice Cauchy problem. So what it proves actually, it's a little bit more. It's basically that you have a nice decay on this solution. And then, of course, once you know the decay, so the algebraic decay of the solution at infinity, then you infer this theorem. You know how the things decay. And of course, you have a decay in dimension 2 also, but in dimension 2, it turns out that the solution presumably does not belong to the H1. So, any solution constructed, presumably, except the trivial one, presumably does not belong to the space. So here's the optimal rate of what people think it's the optimal rate, but it's not so, so clear. So just the idea is to use again this linear operator. You're looking at a linear part, and then you, as usual, what you have to do is to compute the decay of the kernels of these terms, and then to use a nonlinear machinery to get the same decay for the solution. The first step in this decay is you have to prove some decay of the solution at infinity, and then you can infer the machinery to get the optimal one. So this kind of method was used before by Lee Bonnard, Saut de Bois, and maybe many others. So, and it works quite. Which one? This one? Yeah. What is infinity? Ah, the green here. Yeah. Ah, H1. It's infinity. So, yeah. That's right. Not completely. But that's nothing to do with the previous one. So, but the regularity.
And the decay of W is rapid.
Right. It's not extremely rapid, but it's algebraic, but not exponential. So it's not like Laplace nu plus u. Not faster than that's an exact rate, sixth rate where it decays, and I should mention it was conjectured also by all the physicists. So they're very good, of course, in this stuff. But there was no proof, so the computations and it seems that it's the optimal rate he obtained. So of course it's difficult to check since we don't know any solution, but that's point. So let me turn to existence result. Here again, so the starting point was some, maybe my picture is not very clear, I don't know. The starting point was again, I think I have to explain what is going on here. But basically what you do here is a diagram. You have two quantities which are conserved, so the energy and the momentum. And maybe I should draw it again. And these people I mentioned, so in the, I think it's on a period of, say, 10 years between 74 and 86, so 12 years, they computed some solutions, first in the 2 decays and second in the 3 decays. So here I'm drawing the 3 decays. I'm not completely sure about my slopes, but nevertheless. And what they say is that you have two branches of solution which exist. And here, of course, the speed is not a parameter in this picture. You just put the two quantities you know. And basically, you have two branches of solution. So C goes to zero here. And the second one is when you go to close to the speed of sound, C square root of 2. And so what you see is that this solution, as we will see, corresponds to vertex rings. And this was the more linear mode, so it corresponds to acoustic waves, but so they have a very high, they are very spread out, and they have also very large energy. So large energy, large momentum. So the minimizing ones should be this one. So what you can do is to minimize your fixed momentum, and you minimize the energy, then you should lie on this branch. And this people are expected to be stable, because you obey some variational principle, and you cannot just go out. And of course, what happens in this region, so when you're looking at this region, you see that in three dimensions, in this region, you have no traveling waves. So that's very interesting from the point of view of dynamics, because when you start, say, somewhere here, so the reasonable conjecture is that you will go to linear scattering. So according to this Lowy rule, W squared plus K squared plus K4. And that's, of course, not proof, because there has to be done some computation. And the other thing you can see is that if you try to minimize momentum, energy for fixed momentum or the other way, then what will happen is that you have no minimizer. Otherwise, you would have a solution. And from that point of view, you can imagine that the minimizing solution somehow has to go to the scattered solution. So, but this is a region which has not been widely investigated yet. So the regions which have been somewhat investigated, in three dimensions, only this region actually really was investigated. In two dimensions, the picture is quite different, because you have just one curve. So that's n equal 2. You have the same picture, but the curve goes up to the origin. So when you're looking at this acoustic, so in this region you have again acoustic modes, and here you go to zero, and you have say dipole. When you're going to this region, then there are some results here in two dimension and here. And what happens basically here is that you can minimize at each state the energy for fixed momentum. So you can take the momentum P and you minimize, and then you get, say, a soliton which appears. And that, of course, means that the dynamical theory is very different in dimension 2 and in dimension 3. So if you start with, say, not too much energy, then you just expect to get a standard stochastic theory. So, linear scattering theory. Okay, so what? So as I mentioned here, so maybe I just can explain in a few minutes why the two pictures are different. Because first, when you do after some scalings, you end up with some equations which are, of course, all the same. But then you do the computations in dimension 2, it turns out that these solutions are very extended. So you could introduce some parameter which is square root, say, this epsilon. But it's not against the Ginsburg-Landau epsilon. C squared minus 2, no, minus this guy. So when this parameter is small, then these guys are very extended. And in the y direction, they're like 1 over epsilon in length. And in the other direction, like 1 over epsilon squared. And so when you integrate the energies and so on in two dimensions, that end up to be finite and small. Whereas when you have one more dimension to integrate, that everything diverges. So you have no hope to get solution in this region. They have to blow up. Whereas in two dimensions, it's pretty different. Okay, so let me... that's the one I want to put. So with Gian Domenico Orlandi and Didier, we studied the lower branch here, because that's easier. And also it's consistent with Ginsburg-Landau theory and all the talks we had before. Maybe it's not easier, but at least we know how more to do this kind of things. And one of the points was also to derive some stability properties. So basically, you really want stability in the sense that you would like to prove that the solutions which are obtained are minimized for the potential P, the Ginsburg-Landau energy. And so The fact is that these solutions basically behave like a vortex ring, like this. So when you draw this vortex ring, you have a winding number which goes here around, and they all go in this direction. Okay, maybe I just give the statement of the theorem. So one thing which is So here you have the computations. The speed of a traveling wave solution here, correct? No. So it's very small. Its energy behaves like the volume, say, of a circle, so the lamp. So that's the usual relation we saw before. So it's really going like a lamp, and the momentum is also very the energy is large and the momentum is large. The speed in this scaling is small, but if you do some change of scaling, and so you have to think that this goes like, say, the range of this is, say, like one over epsilon. And so you have a very large ring, and if you want to see the picture more in a more clear way, then you have to rescale everything. And then I'm not going to write it because I think David is has to have get too much Ginsburg-Landau in the last section. But nevertheless, you can rescale it, and then you find a vortex ring of size 1. And this, of course, so the real equation you're going to look at is this one. So sorry, I prepared my transparencies before, and in any case, of course, this is basically, if you think of the dynamics here of this time of flight, it is known, and also there are some works by Bob about this question, that the correct speed should be very fast, like 1 over log epsilon. And that's also consistent with classical solution in fluid dynamics. You know, you have solution of this vortex ring, works by, if you look back to the Euler equation, which is not compressible, basically in the limit epsilon goes to 0, you go back to classical incompressible Euler equation, since rho squared over 4, that doesn't too much come into play. And for this classical solution, it's known that they have infinite speed, so they don't really exist in the standard Euler equation. This, I don't know who worked this out, Benjamin, maybe some of these people, or even before, so maybe. But if you're using the Ginsburg-Landau model, you have a sort of regularizing them and with small speed. And how much time do I have? 5 minutes. So maybe I just give a word about the method. Before I go to the sixth, there's a huge difference between 2D and 3D also in this thing, because in 2D the corresponding solution is the plus vortex, plus and minus vortex, and they will travel with finite speed. And the limit which corresponds to countable, say, singular Euler equation is also very well known in Helmholtz. I don't know who invented them. But at least you don't have to change the speed. So they really exist in this classical setting. In this setting, the speed goes to infinity. So they don't really mean anything. And therefore, the fact that you have very concentrated things in the scaling means that you have also very high energy. Okay, so I just finish about this. Of course, you have a variational interpretation of this people. I will be very. So this is the things everybody hates now. So, and this is the momentum, and which is a very simple quadratic form. So the basic idea is to minimize the energy for fixed momentum, and when what comes up is basically the speed as a Lagrange multiplier. So, moreover, if you're able to prove that this infimum is really achieved, then you can deduce maybe some stability for the solutions. One fact is that you have a nice Cauchy problem which is well posed in view of Clausius' theorem, and you know that the solution belongs to this nice space, which is H1 plus 1, or any constant, and so you have a dynamics which is well posed, and the main thing is then to prove that you really minimize on the constraint. And that's it's a little technical, maybe I will just mention some of the difficulties. So the first thing is that this momentum, as I said, the thing is that you know that the solution belongs to H1 plus 1. However, if you want to implement a variational method, you cannot just consider this set because it's not suited for this variational technique. So you have to define P not on Y, which is the energy space, that's the first one, which is which was on X, which is the energy finite, so on this space, and that's not so easy. So it's not, you cannot do it directly. So then you have to find a good function, then bound your Lagrange multiplier, and then to have some compactness principle. One of the ways we found to avoid these difficulties was to work on expanding toroids, and then to go to the limit. Of course, one thing which is clear is that when you work on a toroid with finite n here, then compactness is, of course, you work on a compact domain, so there's no difference between H1 and this energy space. And, of course, there's no difficulty either to define this momentum, since it's a lower order term. But you can do it on this toroid, and then the other step, is to go to the limit, and then you have to use some asymptotic theory for the Ginzburg-Landau, so I will not mention what is exactly behind this, but however, I would like to say the main idea behind the fact that just to finish, why should we find circles? So the main thing is that the relation between this minimizing problem P epsilon, which I should have put on the other side, in that mess, I don't think I will find it in a suitable time. So minimize the energy for you can have a geometric interpretation for this stuff, and the fact is that it's related to the isoperimetric problem. So just to complete, so there's another point of view which you can work out, but which is more difficult, is to think what kind of information, so in the streamlines of Peter's talk, what kind of information can you get from the equation for the vortices? And it turns out that the kind of the equivalent for the so you have a line in n equal 3, and you assume that this line is a solution, so it comes from the solution of the Ginzburg-Landau energy. And so basically the statement is that the corresponding Ginzburg, say, Euler equation for this line, it's a curvature equation for the line. And basically the equation writes like this. So you have to think that you have the curvature vector and so on, tau, k, and here you have this b, I don't know how you, the Frenet binormal. And do you call it the Frenet? No. Yeah. Oh, that's fine. So the Frenet thing? Frame. So the Frenet frame, and so the equation is that the curvature should be look like, say, C as a vector, so C is our cross tau. So you have the curvature equation for this vector. So when you have is this correct? I think. So if you add also, and so if you have a circle, that's the solution to this equation. So you have a circle. So you have C going that way, so K is in that way. So you can figure out that it works. There are, of course, other solutions which are helicoidal. And the work I mentioned by David Chiron, which is ongoing, is to prove the existence of these helicoidals in this framework. And maybe just to have a minute to finish, we found out that it's there's a striking analogy between this. Of course, you can embed this this equation in a larger class of equation. Just write C times gradient U, say log epsilon, equals, say, Laplacian U plus. And so you might say, what is the corresponding Euler equation for this equation? And it's basically the same if you assume that the divergence of C is equal to zero. And then going a little bit further, you find that the equation, in superconductivity you have a system of two equations, and the first one can be written that way if you allow some modification here in this term, and you find exactly the same equation. So in superconductivity, the curvature equation, it's again almost the same. So in superconductivity, people usually call this vector A, and so it's related to the vector potential in the Coulomb gauge. So you have to go to the Coulomb gauge to have this clearly affirmed. So that means that in superconductivity, vortex lines have to be bent. So you have a bending equation. Of course, maybe just finish, but you might say, okay, that's easy. You have just one solution in one dimension of this type of equation, and then you recover the circle. But that's not so easy, because that's a weaker statement. It's for varifold and so on. So that doesn't allow. Also, I didn't mention that here there should be put some factor, which is basically for experts of the quotient of the density of the Jacobians to the density of the energy. So we have to take into account this ratio to make things work. So, however, so of course, the happy thing is that the Euler equation is consistent with the minimizing problem. So you find that you have the right solution. So maybe I will not talk about this, and I will stop here. So thank you for. Yes.